This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
I'm Natalia Melman Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2. And of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Laura Jones. From Witness History, this is a special episode to mark Black History Month in the US. We've brought together some of the highlights from our show, looking back at the challenges and victories of the African-American journey. Our nine-minute stories from history, featured on weekdays on the World Service, are told through the people who were there. Make sure you subscribe to Witness History, wherever you get your BBC podcasts, so you never miss an episode. A warning, some of the following stories contain depictions of violence that may be upsetting. Let's begin at the end of the 19th century. After the Civil War, African Americans in southern states faced a wave of political and racial violence. In response, thousands sought to leave the US and travel to Liberia. Professor Kenneth Barnes is from the University of Central Arkansas. He told Rob Walker about a series of letters revealing why so many black Arkansans dreamed of Liberia and what awaited them there.
Sometimes I feel like I'm almost gone.
At the end of the 19th century, a terrifying wave of political violence was directed at black people in the American South. Many left the southern states in response. But what was extraordinary was that thousands of African Americans attempted to travel all the way to Liberia in West Africa, a place they saw as their only chance of living freely and safely. This is a story that starts in the late 1800s, but details about it only came to light much more recently after an unexpected discovery.
I came across a stray reference to the school that black and white students attended closed down because all the black families left for Liberia, and that was a very curious statement.
Kenneth Barnes is a professor of history at the University of Central Arkansas. He started trying to find out who these black families were and why they'd gone to Liberia, and he discovered a fascinating and dramatic series of letters.
Letter from H.C. Cade, Camden, Arkansas, November the 20th, 1890. Dear Sir, we do not feel safe to stay here, as on the night before the last election here, the white Democrats, about 50 in number, rode through the township with their guns and called us out, threatening to kill us if we went to the election the next day.
This is one of thousands of letters sent during this period to the American Colonization Society. The society was originally set up during the time of slavery to help black people emigrate to Liberia, a place which was portrayed as a refuge for them back in their ancestral homeland. But more than 20 years after the end of the American Civil War, and with it the end of slavery, why were so many African Americans trying to get to Liberia?
After the end of the Civil War, black men had voting rights and actually enjoyed participation in politics. Some of them served in public office and so forth in Arkansas and in other southern states. Basically, on the local level in some of those counties, black people were the determining force that determined who would win the elections and then served in office.
And that was a threat to the leaders of the white-dominated Democratic Party that was in power in Arkansas, especially as growing numbers of black people migrated in from neighboring states looking for farming land.
In the 1880s, there were hard times in the economy, and particularly poor farmers suffered. And white poor farmers began to defect from the political party they had traditionally been loyal to in the South, and that's the Democratic Party. They formed a third party that just stood for the interest of poor people. And when they did that, they formed a formal alliance with the Republican Party, where most of the black males were voting. So we have this strange situation in the 1880s in Arkansas of an alliance of poor people, black and white, who are challenging the authority of the wealthy. And that was really a prompt to strike back at black people, because it was sort of like the weakest link in the coalition. The easiest element to strike at was to remove the votes of the black men, and then this whole coalition would fall apart.
What followed was a wave of political violence aimed at preventing black people from voting. Then, to cement their grip on power, the leaders of the Democratic Party in Arkansas and in other southern states brought in laws to disenfranchise black people.
Once people weren't voting, then they lost basic civil rights in many other ways, too. There was a rash of political violence, racial violence, lynchings. Arkansas had actually a greater number of lynchings, if you look at it on a per capita basis, than any other state in the United States.
As a response to the violence and political repression, growing numbers of black people sought help from the American Colonization Society to travel to Liberia. More emigrants left from Arkansas than any other southern state.
In the 1820s, there was a settlement of the first African Americans to a place on the West Coast that will eventually become Liberia. But as things really deteriorated in the 1880s and 1890s, the movement to return to Africa became of epic proportions.
Letter from B.T. Willis, October the 14th, 1890. Dear sir, I have a few questions to ask you about going to Liberia. Are there white people over in Liberia? Well, if there is, none are going there. But, dear sir, if that is Negro country, and we can be free and speak our own mind, make our own laws, then we are ready to come at once.
There were thousands of people in Arkansas over a period of about 5 to 6 years who applied to immigrate to Liberia, but in the end, about 600 of them were actually chosen. So really, just a fraction of those interested were able to migrate to Liberia.
And that was because the American Colonization Society only had resources to help a small number who applied. But for this 600, new and very different lives lay ahead.
Letter from N. M. Rogers of Liberia to his family in Morrilton, Arkansas, September 20th, 1895. Dear Father, we don't have everything here as plentiful as there, but in a few years when we begin to raise our coffee, we will have what we want. One thing I like, there are no white men to give orders. We have no foreman over us. We are our own boss. We work when we want to, and sit down when we choose, and eat when we get ready.
Come, my brother, always from home.
It was really hard to find out anything about what happened to these migrants after they left the United States, because they quit writing these letters, you know, to the American Colonization Society. So as part of my research, I went to Liberia, went to the specific communities that were settled by the folks from Arkansas, and just basically went walking around asking for people by certain names that I knew had immigrated from Arkansas. But eventually I found dozens of people, and they had a remarkable body of oral history. One of the most interesting stories I had was a single mother who had a large family and decided to leave for Liberia and take her whole family with her. And I found descendants of her there in Johnsonville, Liberia, who still had the stories about her courage and the difficulties of living in a thatched roof hut until she could build a house, and then how eventually over time she and others began to establish a life and institutions there. I found a church. Her name was on the cornerstone of it as one of the founders of the Morning Star Missionary Baptist Church in Johnsonville, Liberia. And her name was listed there, Sister Narcissi Moore.
Come, my sister.
The migration to Liberia petered out once the American Colonization Society stopped supporting the journeys of new emigrants. For black people who stayed in Arkansas, meanwhile, life remained hard.
Political violence did decline, but there were to be no major reforms in the American South until the 1950s and 60s, when the civil rights movement demanded voting rights for African Americans and an end to racial segregation.
Rob Walker speaking with Professor Kenneth Barnes. Let's jump now to the late 1960s, when Eldridge Cleaver, one of the leaders of the radical African American Black Panther Party, spent more than 3 years in exile in Algeria. Mike Lanchin spoke with Elaine Klein Moctafi, a left-wing American woman who was living in the capital, Algiers, at the time. She became Cleaver's fixer and close confidant during his exile.
It was in June of 1969 that Elaine Klein first heard the news that would change her life when a friend phoned her at her Algiers apartment.
He said to me, "Eldridge Cleaver is in town. He needs help. Go see him as quickly as possible. He's at the Victoria Hotel." And he hung up.
Excited to meet one of the best-known leaders of the radical African-American Black Panther Party, Elaine rushed across town early the next morning.
I walked up, three or four stories and knocked on the door. And lo and behold, there was Eldridge Cleaver in front of me. He was twice my size. He's a powerful-looking person. He welcomed me into the room, and his wife Kathleen was stretched out on a bed. She was 8 months pregnant at the time. We stood, we didn't sit down, and he started telling me his story.
Cleaver's story was complicated. The 33-year-old had joined Huey Newton and Bobby Seale in the Black Panthers after his release from jail in 1966. 2 years later, Cleaver was involved in a shootout with police in California, and he was arrested again and charged with murder. But he skipped bail and fled to communist-ruled Cuba. The Cubans, though, had sent him on to Algeria. He wanted Elaine, a left-wing Jewish American woman working with the new government in Algeria, to help him.
And so that afternoon, I called a representative who was in charge of liberation movements in Algiers. He was a commandant. And I told him that Cleaver was in town, that he had just come from Havana, and that he'd like to stay in the country if it was possible. And the commandant said immediately, "Yes, of course.
You want an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people? This is very, very important. And here, whether you know it or not, is where you start dealing with the black revolution."
The Black Panthers were formed in Oakland, California in 1966. With their emblematic berets and black leather jackets and their call to fight back against police violence, the Panthers represented a challenge to mainstream American politics and to the non-violent civil rights movement.
Black power to black people. Black power! We say Panther power to the Vanguard Party.
Armed confrontation with the police was common, but the Black Panthers also espoused universal health care, better housing and education for America's poorest black communities. Here's Eldridge Cleaver speaking about his world vision to the BBC in 1969.
The important thing is that socialism has never been given a chance in the world. All of the countries that have gotten their liberation and that have tried to apply the principles of socialism have found themselves in the position where they've had to use a vast amount of their resources for defense budgets and a lot of cloak-and-dagger operations to withstand the aggressions being constantly plotted against them by the capitalists and the imperialists who are trying to retard their progress.
This mixture of Marxism and self-determination was music to the ears of the new rulers in Algeria, who'd recently fought and won a brutal civil war against France.
Algeria was so open to the causes of liberation. All the liberation movements and guerrilla movements had offices in Algiers. From the French language people of Quebec to the Viet Cong, I was in touch with a great many of them through my work as a journalist and as a translator and interpreter.
Elaine soon became fixer, interpreter and co-conspirator for Eldridge Cleaver and the other Panther members who arrived seeking refuge in Algeria. She helped them get a monthly government stipend to live off, and fixed up an office for Cleaver and the others in a villa in the hills dubbed the Embassy. She helped smuggle a minibus for the Panthers from Germany to Algeria, and on one occasion also helped get stolen US passports into the country for them to use as fake IDs. But there were times when Cleaver tested Elaine's loyalty almost to the limits.
He came into my office, he sat down, he took off his glasses, which he called shades, and said very clearly, "I killed Rahim last night." And then he got, after he made his confession, he got up and walked out.
Clinton Rahim Smith was a fellow Panther who Cleaver claimed had been about to run off with the organisation's money. It later transpired that Rahim had been spotted at an Algiers nightclub with Cleaver's wife, Kathleen, whilst Cleaver was away drumming up support in North Korea. Did it change how you felt about Eldridge?
To some extent, of course, it did. I knew that one had to be wary of him, that you couldn't predict his reactions. For a while, we didn't see each other. Then he started coming back. He came to the office, and we talked about other things. We never talked about it again.
And there was also violence directed at Kathleen Cleaver and other women, which Elaine says she did challenge Cleaver about.
I did ask him why he was so brutal with his wife. She certainly didn't warrant it. His answer to me was really unacceptable. He said that some people demand to be treated that way. I felt that was it was a terrible way of explaining his own shortcomings.
But like many of those around him, Elaine was perhaps unwilling or unable to stand up to the Black Panther leader and his violent outbursts. She clearly admired Cleaver and his cause, and when he eventually left Algeria at the end of 1972, having fallen out with its rulers, she says that it left a huge hole in her life. Eldridge Cleaver eventually returned to the US, where he later became a born-again Christian and a member of the Republican Party. He died in May 1998, aged 62. Elaine later also moved back to the US with her Algerian husband.
I'm glad that I did what I could. It would just seem normal to me, and it still seems normal to me. I've never glorified it. I've never overestimated any role that I played. I just sort of... glad that I got out of it all alive.
And no regrets?
No regrets whatsoever. On the contrary. On the contrary, it's the best part of my life.
You're listening to a special episode of Witness History from the BBC World Service, looking back at notable moments in African American history. I'm Laura Jones. Our next story is about the first African American woman to lead a World War II battalion. Major Charity Adams led the 6888, a majority African-American women's unit. You may have heard of the battalion from the recent Netflix movie about its efforts. Marverine Cole has the story.
It's winter and the bitter end of 1944, following 5 long years of war. A US military plane is flying over the Atlantic from the United States to an unknown destination in Europe. Inside is Major Charity Adams, quietly making history as the first African-American woman to be sent abroad as leader of nearly 1,000 women of colour on a landmark World War II mission.
Well, you don't really think history when you're doing something. It's not history until after you do it. So actually, I understood that several officers had wanted that assignment, but I had the most troop experience. So if you're going to send nearly 1,000 people overseas, you want somebody who has troop experience.
Travelling at an altitude of about 30,000 feet, Charity Adams is about to open a sealed envelope, which will reveal her orders.
Although I didn't know what the job was, and I didn't know where I was going when I left the state, I knew that, and this is a premise that I have used in the Army and any place else, given the same opportunity and training, I'm sure I can do as well as anybody else.
Charity's son, Stanley Early, tells me that his mother was highly qualified by her mid-20s to get to this point, rising to battalion leader at a time when racial segregation was still the norm. It meant she had to be better than the rest.
She had been preparing for this opportunity, and my mother is a preparer. She was a very thorough person. So these women knew that they were not just representing themselves, but they were representing black people too. Everybody had at least a high school diploma. A lot of them had college. They were better educated than most units. So they were a select group in many ways.
Charity Adams, as commanding officer, was being sent ahead of her battalion to prepare for their arrival. But where were they heading? And what were they being sent there to do? Charity Adams recalls in an interview she gave to the US Army Women's Museum in 1990, the moment she opens the envelope.
We thought we were going to Paris. And we opened our sealed orders 1 hour after we were in flight and found that we were going to London. And we reported to the White Staff Director there, and we found out that we were going to be in the Postal Directory Service.
Mountains of mail addressed to soldiers from their loved ones had been piling up over the course of the war. It was becoming impossible to deal with, but delivery is considered crucial to the war effort in helping lift the spirits of beleaguered troops risking their lives on the front lines. They needed their letters and parcels from loved ones to feel connected to home.
Well, we worked for a week with the Postal Service under the Adjutant General's office. We paid all the respect calls you're supposed to pay, and then we set out getting the place ready for our troops to come.
They are stationed at the King Edward School in Birmingham, England, waiting for the full battalion to arrive. Over 800 in total join, nearly all of them African-American women, who became known as the 6888. They set to work under the motto, No Mail, Low Morale.
When they got there, there were these hangars that were literally to the roof with packages. There was a wonderful picture I saw once of one of the women sitting on top of this pile, like 20-some feet high, of mail. This stuff had been building for 2 years. And people had been sending, not only do you have mail, but you're sending gifts and cakes that have been sitting for 2 years that have visitors that have been nibbling on them and so forth. You know, with all the, you see, you've got all the vermin you got to deal with. You've got, I don't know, it's like 7,500 Robert Smiths, and you've got this incredible task.
So how do you think your mother went about motivating them to just keep on going and plow on through to get it all done?
It's like you put together a system that works. They were running 24 hours a day in multiple shifts. Everybody had a responsibility, like, you're in shift C and you are taking all the WEs and you're getting this whole system in place so you can move it through. And then you have people who are doing things like making sure the records are right. This person originally was in this unit, but now they're in this unit. This person's dead. This person is now shipped back to the United States. This person is now in the Pacific. How do I get all this routed? And there's no computers. I mean, we're talking pens and cards. And you're doing it 24 hours a day.
Old archive footage without sound exists, showing the women working. It's mesmerising. You see the heavy sacks of mail being opened and women dressed in their knee-length skirts, military jackets and hats, some sitting in rows of desks, carefully placing index cards in the right place. Others are sifting letters into pigeonholes alphabetically and putting packages into the correct sacks. They're working three shifts non-stop. While one shift sleeps, the others are working. They swap over and continue. A question that Charity Adams is asked in her 1990 interview is how they were received during their time in the UK.
The citizens received us quite in hand, but with a lot of curiosity. The American troops received us in lots of ways. The white GIs told tales about us. The Red Cross wanted to segregate us, and the British just wanted to visit us. But I refused to accept any segregated facilities that they wanted to create for them, and after that they didn't try.
The incident of attempted segregation of this majority black female battalion from their white counterparts, both part of the Women's Auxiliary Corps, known by the acronym WAC, happened when they were staying overnight in London.
They all used the same WAC recreational hotel in London, and this is where the real problem came in. The Red Cross wanted to set up another hotel for the black WACs, and I promised them that it would be over my dead body before anybody slept there, and nobody slept there, to my knowledge.
And I felt like she was a motivated person. I mean, that was just who she was. But she also wanted to be respected, and she wanted her women to be respected. And I think they felt, you know, they were part of something. She had their backs. They would go forward.
The 6888 kept motivated despite the challenges of racism and sexism they encountered by meeting with the curious locals of Birmingham, UK, and taking part in some relaxing pursuits.
And my mother was a really good ping pong player. I have a wonderful picture of her playing ping pong in uniform with the bat coming down. They had athletic teams, which were very important. They had a band. My mother talked about the dinners with families in Birmingham. And I do know my mother became a tea drinker. So tea with milk is something that she always had. You know, and there were also things that were important in terms of morale, that, which was a big deal, was getting a hair salon.
They were a self-sufficient battalion whose efficiency meant they completed their work in half the time. The 6888 went on to France to do the same thing there. Their contribution to the war has only recently been recognised. The 6888 were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal, signed into law by President Biden in 2022. Major Charity Adams went on to become Lieutenant Colonel, the highest possible rank for women in her unit. She passed away in 2002.
Marvereen Cole speaking with Stanley Early. This is the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Natalia Melman-Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Laura Jones. This is a special episode to mark US Black History Month, reflecting on some remarkable moments of African American history. Our stories are from Witness History from the BBC World Service. In early 20th century Oklahoma, Greenwood was a flourishing black neighborhood in the city of Tulsa. But in May 1921, a white mob descended on the district, destroying homes, businesses, and lives. Josephine Cassily talks to historian John W. Franklin of Franklin Global about the story of his grandfather, Buck Franklin, who survived the massacre. And a warning, this story contains offensive language and descriptions of violence.
Our story starts on a sunny morning that feels a world away from where this day will end.
It is now May 31st, 1921. The day is just beginning. Sweet-throated birds warble their songs of joy in the treetops, and the dew sparkles upon the grass like countless little diamonds.
We're going to see what happened in Tulsa through the eyes of Buck Franklin. He was an African-American lawyer, and these are words from his autobiography.
An unbroken stream of pedestrians, male and female, passes down Greenwood Avenue. It is made up of laborers and others on their way to work. A few of the more pretentious ones pass in their own cars or in jitneys or upon buses. Then comes a lull before the storm.
Buck first moved to Tulsa in 1921, and the city was booming.
So Tulsa develops as the oil capital of the world from 1905 to 1920. And African Americans benefit from that oil wealth.
That's John Whittington Franklin. He's Buck's grandson and a historian. and he's going to help us tell his grandfather's story.
And the black section of town is called Greenwood, and it has hotels and restaurants and a dozen churches, furniture stores, grocery stores, oil leasing companies.
When oil was discovered in the area, some of it was found on African-American land, bringing money into the community. Greenwood flourished. It had a growing middle class, and the area was so prosperous that it was known as Black Wall Street.
And then given segregation, black dollars circulate in a black business district, generating more wealth. It's a thriving neighborhood, and it's at the edge of downtown Tulsa, just across the railroad tracks.
It was at a hotel in downtown Tulsa that
a young African-American man is accused of attacking or touching a white woman in an elevator.
The white 17-year-old girl, who was called Sarah Page, had been in a lift with a 19-year-old black shoe shiner who was called Dick Rowland. She ran out of the lift screaming, and people believed that she'd been assaulted by Dick. Dick was taken to the courthouse, but the charges of assault against him were eventually dropped, and it's thought by some historians that he probably just tripped and grabbed hold of Sarah's arm. But from the moment that Sarah Page screamed, the match had been lit.
It is now 11:30 a.m., and the first edition of the Tulsa Daily Tribune is out, all about a Negro assaulting a white girl. Read all about it. And so thousands of people buy the paper and scan its pages for the article about the alleged assault. In the twinkling of an eye, a part of Tulsa has changed from happy, joyous, and carefree to looks of grim determination.
White men gather to try to lynch this young man. And so a mob gathers at the courthouse. Some black World War I veterans come with their weapons to defend him. The authorities do not release Dick Rowland, and in anger, the white men seize guns from an armory.
Thousands of white men descended on the black neighborhood of Greenwood. And as night fell, Buck started to hear gunshots.
I, of course, knew that there was a trouble, that a race riot or race war, as it afterward proved to be, was in the making. And that we would soon be in the midst of a great catastrophe if something was not done at once to avert it.
Through the night and into the next day, the white mob ran riot through the black community.
We have eyewitness accounts where people are rousted out of their homes. Their homes are looted of their valuable possessions by these white men.
Buck ventured into the town to check on his law office.
And that's when he witnesses people being shot.
When the old man was hit, no doubt by a dozen bullets, he fell sprawling upon the hard paved street. Blood gushed from every wound and ran down the street. I turned my head from the scene.
He sees these airplanes dropping turpentine balls on the buildings and seeing them catch fire.
I could see planes circling in midair. They grew in number and hummed, darted, and dipped low. I could hear something like hail falling upon the top of my office building. I saw the old Midway Hotel on fire, burning from its top. And then another, and another, and another building began to burn from the top.
Other eyewitnesses also reported seeing shooting and firebombing from planes, but it's still not been established who was flying these planes.
Lurid flames roared and belched and licked their forked tongues in the air. I feared an explosion and decided to try and move to safer quarters. I came out of my office, locked the door, and descended to the foot of the steps. The sidewalks were literally covered with burning turpentine balls.
There are no fire departments coming to their assistance. There are no police coming to their assistance.
I saw a woman on the opposite side of the street, in the very path of whizzing bullets. She was calling wildly to a little tot that a few moments before had dashed away from her in panic. I hollered to her, "Turn back, woman, for God's sake, turn back." Never turning her head, she answered, "I must follow my child." And not a bullet touched her, even though they literally rained down on the street.
And then, as Buck tried to make his way home,
I looked north, and directly in front of us stood 1,000 boys, it seemed, with guns pointed at our heads. One came forward to search us. Finding no weapon, he started to take my money.
The men marched Buck to a convention hall.
It sounds like the entire black community is rounded up and taken to a number of different places.
Buck was kept in the hall for a few days, and when he was released, the city was unrecognizable.
The fires raged and burned everything in their path and left nothing but ashes and burned safes and trunks and the like where once stood beautiful homes and businesses.
The photographs of Greenwood in the aftermath look like a war zone. The whole area was razed to the ground. These photos of the riot were circulated in the years that followed as postcards celebrating the massacre.
Well, many people disappeared. There are reports of bodies floating down the Arkansas River. There are reports of people seeing mass graves. There are reports of people seeing railroad cars full of bodies being taken out of town.
It's now thought that around 300 people were killed and thousands more were left homeless. No one was ever prosecuted for the violence. In his autobiography, Buck argues that the massacre was driven by jealousy towards the prosperous black community.
This is an example of extreme jealousy of what African Americans had acquired. There's extreme white wealth, but majority of the white population was not wealthy. They were not oil barons, but there are many oil workers who had not amassed wealth, had an opportunity to get it quickly from African American homes. Downtown is unscathed. So the rest of the city's fine. And the city ignores this blight and continues to prosper. And Tulsa forgot it actively. And many people growing up in Tulsa, black and white, native and otherwise, did not know about it.
Now the silence is lifting. The massacre has been investigated by a commission.
Our commitment from the city government, though, is that we're going to follow the truth on this wherever it takes us.
And work is starting to excavate the sites of mass graves, where victims are suspected to have been buried. Buck stayed in Tulsa with his family until he died in 1960. In the years that followed the massacre, he dedicated himself to rebuilding Greenwood. He provided support and legal advice to those who'd lost their homes.
And so my grandfather wrote his autobiography after he had a stroke in his later years, and he typed two single-spaced 400-page drafts of this autobiography with his left index finger, having lost use of his right side. So he was a valiant person, a strong-willed person, and he continued to battle for his community through his entire career.
Josephine Casserly speaking with John W. Franklin there. We go next to Washington, D.C., just 30 years ago. In October 1995, white and black America was divided by the trial of O.J. Simpson, and the black unemployment rate was at 10%, double that of white people. Hundreds of thousands of African American men marched on the Capitol in an attempt to put black issues back on the government agenda. They also wanted to promote a positive image of black men. Akilah Powell, 23 at the time, was one of the few women there. She spoke with Ben Carter about what became known as the Million Man March.
It was a sea of people. I don't know where the crowd started and where it ended because there were just people everywhere. And when I looked at the pictures in the Washington Post the next day of how far the crowd extended down the mall, I had never seen anything like that. So many people. I got there pretty early. Somewhere between 7 and 8 o'clock, I think I arrived. There were people from all over the country. I was so surprised that people just bussed in, not just from the East Coast, but they took buses from Oregon and California and Texas. And I was like, wow, those are some really long bus trips. But I just remember people saying, you know, I had to be there. I came with my father. I came with my son. You know, this is a chance for us to come together as a community for our community.
Akilah Powell had a specific reason for being there.
I had just finished college a year earlier. I was working for an organization called the National Coalition on Black Voter Participation, one of the civil rights groups involved with planning the march, and we were out there registering people to vote. Sometimes I would encounter folks that were like, oh, absolutely, I'm registered. I vote in every election. But you would also encounter people that were like, I came back from Vietnam. This country didn't support us. I hadn't been voting, but I'll sign up with you. There were people that had convictions or felonies, and they were saying they thought they couldn't vote and they needed to get more information on the process or getting their record expunged. It ranged the gamut. People definitely saw the importance of it because in a lot of people's minds, voting was the key to getting the resources that we needed for the community. You know, having elected representatives that were going to look out for the community and make sure that fair housing policies were passed and there wasn't any discrimination in employment, or that the schools were receiving the resources that they needed. These were all things that I remember people were really concerned about. A lot of focus on the younger generation. A lot of men were very concerned about their younger brothers, their sons, making sure that they got a fair start in life and they got on the right path.
The march had been organized by a man many Americans saw as controversial.
Clean up, black man, and the world will respect and honor you.
Louis Farrakhan was and remains the leader of the Nation of Islam, an organization that describes itself as an African-American political and new religious movement.
If we start dotting the black community with businesses, opening up factories, challenging ourselves to be better than we are, white folk, instead of driving by using the N-word, they'll say, look at them.
But other organizations took issue with Farrakhan. The Southern Poverty Law Center called the Nation of Islam a hate group that promoted anti-Semitism.
As someone who has been to Israel and knows the history of sort of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I definitely see where there are things that he said that are controversial. But I would say that of all the speeches that day, that was the one where people were the most excited about. He was very fiery. He brought a lot of energy and focus, and there was a lot of anticipation. People were aware of the other things that he had said that were somewhat controversial. But I think for people that were attending that day, they were more focused on Farrakhan as their brother and what he was trying to do to help. And there was less focus, or very little focus, on the negative.
Farrakhan had assembled an impressive group of speakers to join him on stage.
There were quite a few black luminaries of the time that were attending. Several Congress people, members of the Congressional Black Caucus, were there. Rosa Parks was there. Ben Chavis was there. I do remember him speaking because he was affiliated with the Nation of Islam. Reverend Jesse Jackson spoke, Reverend Al Sharpton spoke. The one woman that I do remember speaking was Dr. Maya Angelou.
Let us get from the low road of indifference. Clap hands. Let us come together and reveal our hearts. Let us come together and revive our spirits. Let us come together and cleanse our souls. Clap hands. Let's leave the preening. Stop impostering in our own history. Clap hands.
I was a huge fan of hers, and I was so inspired and grateful that she attended.
It wasn't just well-known people that were given the chance to speak to the huge crowds. Organizers were keen for young voices to be heard too.
Good morning, black men.
Good morning.
My name is Christopher Berry, and I am the 15-year-old son of Mayor Marion Berry. I would like to thank all of you for coming together peacefully on this day of atonement. This is a very special day because many people have worked hard for this day to take place but did not live to see it happen.
Christopher Berry used the word atonement, and that's a word that Aquila Powell remembers Reverend Jesse Jackson mentioning.
Reverend Jackson talked a lot about atonement and how we needed to come together to address the external issues that were having an impact on our community. But we also needed to do better. We needed to do better, and we needed to be better. Better husbands, better fathers, better sons. He believed in the black men that were attending. He believed in them. And I think that, for some people, allowed them to believe in themselves even more.
Did it feel like a historic occasion to you at the time that you were there?
Absolutely. My background is I worked for a congressman and a senator on Capitol Hill. I've been involved in politics and policy pretty much for my entire career. It felt like a one-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I had never experienced anything like that, and I don't know that I have ever experienced anything since then. And keep in mind that this march happened. Clinton was still in office. The midterms had just happened, and the Republican Party took over Congress. So there was definitely concern around how a Democratic president was going to be able to work with a Republican Congress that, by some of the rhetoric that we had been hearing, they were very interested in passing a conservative agenda that did not focus on a lot of the issues that the participants at the Million Man March were concerned about.
Kwila Powell's purpose at the march was to encourage more black men to vote, and 150,000 of them filled out voter registration cards on that day. US Census Bureau data shows that the black turnout rate increased by 13% between 1996 and 2012.
Ben Carter speaking with Akila Powell. And our final story takes us to the grass courts of Wimbledon in London. In 1975, Arthur Ashe became the first African-American man to win the tennis tournament. His friend and agent, Donald Dell, spoke to Louise Hidalgo about that memorable match and about what else Ashe might have achieved if he had not died young.
It's July 1975, and at Wimbledon, one of the great men's finals in the history of tennis is being played on centre court. Facing each other are two Americans, Arthur Ashe and Jimmy Connors. It's 2-1, and Arthur Ashe is serving for the match and the title.
Connors fields the ball. Arthur comes in behind it. Connors pops up the backhand as a lob, short, and Arthur bounces the ball out of the court, and he wins the match.
The crowd's been rooting for Ashe the entire match and is delighted. So too is Arthur Ashe's friend and agent, the legendary sports promoter Donald Dell, who's been watching with his wife, Carol.
Before he shakes hands, he turns to Carol and I in the crowd, and he goes like this with his fist. He's so excited that he's just one
he raises
his right
hand in the air with a clenched fist.
With a closed fist, and he waves at us like that. And of course, the NBC thinks it's the Black Power salute, which was ridiculous. But he's just waving to us because he's excited and he's just won the tournament.
Arthur Ashe had won it against all the odds, at the same time becoming the first black man ever to win the title. Jimmy Connors was number one in the world in 1975 and the reigning Wimbledon champion. No one had thought that Ashe could beat him.
It was really a remarkable upset because he was an underdog 16-1, and Arthur was extremely popular. Connors at that stage was not as popular. He was a very good player, and he sold a lot of tickets in America in tennis.
And can you remember how you felt at that moment? Your best friend, your client, and the first black man ever to win Wimbledon.
Well,
an extraordinary moment.
Yeah, it was. It was quite a moment. I mean, you felt on a, I would say, a high on a high. And Arthur was very excited. And it was just an ecstatic moment. And what I always remember after the match the most was I got a lot of phone calls and notes from friends saying, I was driving down the street in Washington when it was match point. I pulled off the road to hear it.
Arthur Ashe's own journey to get to that point that day had been a remarkable one. Years later, though, talking on the BBC to the Irish psychiatrist Anthony Clare, he told him about the mixed feelings he had about being seen through that filter of the first black man ever to win Wimbledon.
Because there are so many stereotypes about black athletes, there are stereotypes about athletes in general, and even more about black athletes, and that rankles. It rankles when I hear it. It rankles when I see evidences of it. Mm. And part of it, it's a serious attempt on my part not to be in that lump.
Yeah.
But at the same time, to try to be someone whom the other black athletes can point to and say, hey, look, that's ideally the way things should be done.
Arthur Ashe had grown up in Richmond, Virginia, in a large extended family. But when he was six, tragedy struck. His mother died during routine surgery. The young Ashe became withdrawn, retreating into a world of books and of sport. His life as a tennis player, however, began almost by chance.
When I was 10 years old and playing on the courts next to my house in Richmond, Virginia, the tournament director of the black college saw me playing during an idle moment when the courts weren't being used, and from that moment on, things changed. I mean, if I had been playing baseball during that time, if I'd been doing anything else at all, I may not have done anything else that I did later.
Arthur later won a tennis scholarship to the University of California and in the 60s became the first black player to be selected for the U.S. Davis Cup team. It was there he met Donald Dell, who captained the team for 2 years. Ashe went on to win both the U.S. and the Australian Open. By 1975, when he met Jimmy Connors in that iconic Wimbledon final, he was 31, cool, controlled, but already some thought too old to beat the young, brash 22-year-old. The night before the match, Arthur and Donald Dell had dinner together and discussed how he could beat Connors.
Connors was a very, very good competitor.
He was number one in the world at that time.
At that time. He was the longest ranked number one player on the ATP computer for many years. And the next morning, I got up and went downstairs. And I did this a lot in big matches for Arthur. And so I wrote on the back of an envelope. I said, "Dear Lieutenant," when I wanted to get his attention, I would call him Lieutenant, because when he was on the Davis Cup team, he was a lieutenant in the Army. So I wrote him a note and said, "Dear Lieutenant, here are the four or five things we talked about last night. Just some thoughts. Number one, make sure you get your first serve in and try to serve to his backhand as best you can. Connors was left-handed. So number two, his biggest weakness is a low forehand, so keep the ball low on his forehand side." Arthur goes out to play, and suddenly in the third game, he sits down on the changeovers, which are 90 seconds, and he reaches into his racket cover and pulls out this envelope, and he's sitting there reading it. He looks like he's meditating almost because he focused so much. I knew what he was doing, but the BBC and NBC, both started saying, "What is Ash doing? He's reading these notes. Is he meditating? What's he doing?" And the cameras were going crazy because they didn't know, and he won the first set.
Connors did come back in the third set, but in the end, of course, it was Arthur Ashe who took the title. It was the last Grand Slam he would win. 4 years later, Arthur Ashe suffered a heart attack and had to undergo heart surgery. In 1980, he retired from tennis for good. How did he deal so calmly with the knocks that life had dealt him? Anthony Clare would later ask.
You have to internalize things, yes.
Where does it come out with you, other than in your cardiovascular system? Do you ever lose your cool?
Almost never. I think because I would be personally embarrassed if I did. Whereas most other people do it. I mean, John McEnroe does it and is not embarrassed at all.
Yes.
I would be embarrassed. I think I would be embarrassed now at my age because I've never done it before and people would go, "Gee, that's..." Mm. "He doesn't normally do that." Mm. And secondly, because in the beginning, we thought such outbursts would reflect back on us as a race here in the U.S., that you'd have people say, "See? You see what you get when you give a few of them an opportunity to do this, that, or the other? They foul it up. They transgress the codes of etiquette or whatever." So, of course, that's not true now. I mean, if I were coming along now, if I were 10 years old now, I would be much freer to be like John McEnroe.
But he wasn't. He was a very different character, and one that his great friend Donald Dell still misses.
You know, he was very quiet, very soft-spoken, had a very high IQ. He was a photographic memory and a speed reader. I mean, he was, I mean this quite sincerely, he was really the forerunner, in my judgment, to Barack Obama. He was going to run for office in New York State. He probably would have run for the Senate. I was going to be very involved in his campaign, and then he got AIDS. And, of course, that changed his whole life dramatically. He got AIDS on a second blood transfusion at a hospital outside of Harlem in New York because they didn't protect the blood in the early 80s, and nobody knew what the hell AIDS was. And so, in my judgment, it was a tremendous loss for America because Arthur Ashe really mattered.
Arthur Ashe died in February 1993, aged 49. After his death, his body lay in state at the governor's mansion in his home state of Virginia, a rare honour for a US citizen.
Louise Hidalgo speaking with Donald Dell. That brings us to the end of our US Black History Month special. These stories of key moments in African American and civil rights history were brought to you by Witness History. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your BBC podcasts. I'm Laura Jones. You've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Natalia Melman-Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2. And of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme,
peak danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.